Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, February 25th. First, I'm opening a work session on possible bill introduction. However, we're going to carry this over and do a work session on possible bill introduction tomorrow. So it's carried over. Do I officially close the work session? Okay, today's work session is closed. I am opening a public hearing now on House Bill 2168 and on House Bill 2684. These have been carried over from February 21st. These are related to a company that builds, maintains, and operates a project constituting certain communication services infrastructure. LRO, would you open this for us?
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Both 2684 and 2168 are identical bills. One of them is a committee bill and one is sponsored by Representative Nose. They're intended to repeal the property tax exemption for what's come to be known as the gigabit exemption.
Thank you. We do not have any new members of the public who've signed up to testify. Representative Nose and Representative Smith Warner, you're going to be joining. Thank you.
I brought all my files.
Are you submitting them for the record?
No, I am not, Madam Chair. I think your staff and others did a pretty good job. I watched the hearing. Okay, Chair Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rob Nose, and I represent House District 42, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of House Bill 2684, a bill that calls for the repeal of the gigabit exemption. I started examining this tax credit in the spring of 2017 when the Speaker asked me to, and I tried to pass a version of this bill in the short session of 2018. I'm just curious, how much explanation have you had about intangible taxation? It's kind of like Joyce and Finnegan, Representative Fernandez. You know?
We would love to hear more about intangibles.
Briefly, all right. The concept of intangible taxation dates back to the start of the railroads in the United States. Now, the value of the railroad is not just the physical property going through the city or county, but the value of that railroad, its connection to other parts of the railroad line and other counties. That's the intangible value, okay? And of course, you know, there's a way to measure it and tax it, though you'd have to have the Department of Revenue up here to explain it in front of you, because I'm not exactly sure how it's done, but that's part of central assessment, okay? A little bit more history. In 2015, in my first term, I was not on this committee, and we passed Senate Bill 611. The tech industry and the telecommunications industry were complaining about the way Oregon taxes intangibles. And we made some changes to make it a little bit more palatable to them. And I think Wendy from the League of Oregon Cities, in the testimony I was able to review that she gave, did a pretty good job of providing background on that topic. You should know we have high intangible taxes relative to other states. At the same time in 2015, I think you heard how Google was making an offer to come to the city of Portland and lay a bunch of high-speed cable fiber for gigabit, both upload and download. And when Google was contemplating this in their talks with the city of Portland and others, they voiced concerns about our state's high intangible taxes, and based on their read of our laws, the intangible value of Google and the cable they would lay would make it so that basically they would not want to come and do the project in the city of Portland. It's Google, right? I mean, I get it. Their intangible value must be, well, probably a lot. So in order to get them to consider the project, we created the gigabit tax exemption. We basically said we would exempt all their intangibles. Now, we don't tend to create tax breaks for one entity, but I suspect that is kind of what we thought we were doing. And in my defense, Madam Chair, I was not on the Revenue Committee, and Chair Barnhart often said it takes three sessions to figure out if we got a tax policy right or if we messed it up. You should not be surprised that other entities in other parts of this industry asked to get gigabit exemptions. They submitted projects for review and got approved, And Google, by the way, decided, as we all know, not to come to Portland and lay fiber. Once Comcast and Frontier submitted projects and the Public Utility Commission said they were qualified, that is when the cities and counties and school districts got concerned, and here we are. You probably already know that this tax break is a two-step process. You have to have a qualified project as determined by the Public Utility Commission, and then get approval also from the Department of Revenue, and there's a bit of a dispute about that process. Where am I going with all this? Senate Bill 611 is a way to deal with some of the concerns about intangible taxation, and it tried to incentivize Google to bring their fiber network to Oregon for the purpose of making gigabit available. The bill was probably not as carefully vetted as it perhaps should have been. We could probably say that about a lot of bills that we pass. And as a result, Senate Bill 611 was passed containing unclear and sometimes contradictory language. Now I believe Comcast is not seeking the exemption. Frontier is still pursuing it based on their gigabit project, and others are waiting, I believe, pending what happens to Frontier and what this committee does. While we may need gigabit services of this nature in our state, both upload and download, this tax exemption is not the right way to make it happen. We should start over. It's too generous a tax break. We should stop offering it. 5G is coming, and the private sector is providing it without our state offering a tax break to do it. If you all agree, we should stop offering this tax break, and you should decide when to end it. I think that is important because Frontier has a qualified project and has sought the exemption and has had their claim held up a little bit. Presumably, they have spent money based on a promise this legislature made, and it might not be right to essentially punish them for making the investment by just taking this tax exemption away. Though, I'm not sure that they should be made completely whole for all of their investment either. The cost of this exemption is basically a dollar-for-dollar break for their investment. And in a time when we have an underfunded education system and underpaid social workers, I'm not sure we should be giving such a large tax break to incentivize behavior and provide a service that we don't need to have such a large tax break to be able to be offered. It's not serving that many people. So I respectfully ask that the committee you repeal this tax break and that we figure out how much Frontier should be made whole for their financial outlay.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs, fellow members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner. I serve on the Revenue Committee with you, and I also represent House District 45, which is Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. I wanted to testify in support of both of these bills, which whether we go with Rep. Nose's version or the committee version, and to echo a lot of what my colleague spoken about. As we frequently discuss in this committee, we have a choice to decide when to allow tax exemptions and which behaviors or actions we should use taxpayer money to incentivize. As technology changes at lightning fast speed, sometimes the solutions that we as legislators create are not able to keep up with the details and scope that the technology and corresponding infrastructure needs. That's why I believe strongly in these bills and the clean repeal that they prescribe, because it will allow us to take on the issue of broadband access, which is what I know a lot of the conversation about this has been on, in a more precise and effective way. And we can also protect taxpayer funds from being utilized in ways that were not the intention of the original exemption. I believe and say all the time that broadband access is the rural electrification of the 21st century. It is essential for communities in rural Oregon to be able to thrive. We need to be able to give ways for those communities and individuals there to be able to do the same things that you're able to do in metro areas about having the internet access that you need in order to start and maintain businesses and engagement in businesses generally. I still believe that we need to figure out how we can support its access, but this is not the way to do it. And again, I think anytime we try to legislate technology, we almost always end up in this situation where technology exceeds our ability to legislate it. So to me, the gigabit exemption is not part of the solution, and I urge this committee to eliminate it by supporting whichever one of these two bills, 2684 or 2119. Is that the other number? That we choose to go forward with. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Nose and Smith Warner, for your testimony. Question for you is, I'm just remembering back to 2018 when I sat over there and was trying to figure out what revenue was. Is this a property tax or an income tax break?
Property tax.
It's property tax. Okay,
property
great.
Tax.
So I just wanted to make sure I was correct on that. And then the second thing is, has there been any discussion or thought into a phase out or a grandfathering clause which would allow those that have come in to do that and then phase out over time rather than just a hard drop off?
So, Chair Nathanson and Representative Reschke, I think that's a great question for you all to sort of wrestle with. In 2018, the way the bill was crafted, every entity that had sort of had a qualified project would have basically been able to have 1 year of that tax credit to sort of, in my mind, be made whole for the investment. Since the failure of that bill to pass, the lawsuit that Comcast has had with our state for years and years and years going has been settled, and as part of that settlement, they agreed not to apply for this property tax break. Frontier is still sort of in a little bit of a limbo. I'm unclear if they have gotten some of the first year's tax break, and I know that they believe they ought to have some, they've made continued investment, and they believe they should have more, and I think that's something that we should debate. You know, I'm not aware of any tax break that we offer where there's a dollar for dollar break from us in exchange for the investment that a business makes. I think we try to use tax breaks to incentivize the private sector when banks and loans and interest rates don't seem to be doing the trick. And I'm not sure that we need to make them whole dollar for dollar. That said, in 2018, we did say we were going to keep them whole for at least that first year. So I think that's the challenge that you have. And I think if you don't repeal this, you're going to see other telecom folks get into this space, and then you're going to see your school districts and your cities and county government screaming even more about what it's doing to their property tax base.
Thank you.
Representative Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Rep. Nelson, Rep. Smith Warner. I would have to say that last February, I sat next to you when you rolled out your bill and seen your incredible notes and tried to figure out what the heck does this really be. And I read most of your notes over your shoulder as we went through the course of the session. But thanks for your testimony today. I hear and agree with everything that you've said. I do believe that we have to make sure that we honor our word, and a deal is a deal in some regard. I mean, thankfully, Comcast is not in the picture, but Frontier was given a lot of agreements and suggestions, and they've invested a fair amount of money. And I agree with your analogy that we need to look at that and figure out how to get an off-ramp for that through some dialogue. Is that what I'm kind of paraphrasing, but I believe that's probably a good thought.
So if you don't mind, Representative Finley, I'll start with that. Madam Chair, Representative Finley. Yes, and I think I was looking at this again over the weekend, and there's some good materials in the meeting materials. There's a document from the PUC that talks about the investment that they know Frontier to have made, and the amount of credit that they have already gotten for this. My reading of those documents was that they have already gotten a significant credit for this, for at least first year investment. And so I would like us to kind of review that, look through the notes and the discussions from where we got to in 2018, and figure out if we have gotten there with them. Do we need something else in at the same time or not? Or if it's been covered. And indeed, I still believe it's important to just plain cut it off now to keep that from, just so that we can move on from this.
Yes.
So, and I'm not disagreeing with you for a second, but I think probably the main consideration is on page 2, line 31, where it says July 31st, 2019. Perhaps that's a date we ought to look at to do that analysis, to see their financials, the impacts of the agreements, and where that really should be, whether it's that or further down the road.
I think that's the discussion we have to have, is how whole do you want to make Frontier? and the process of ending this at the same time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for our colleagues? Thank you for being here this morning.
I'm going to go back to committee.
Thank you.
Maybe I'll come down on Wednesday.
A representative from the Department of Revenue is here. Would you like to add any additional information or clarification for us?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Mark Arce with the Department of Revenue. So just to clarify, the company, and Representative Smith Warner did a great job pointing to the PUC report that's available online. The company did receive 1 year's worth of exemption already. So there was testimony that they had received a few months, and it might feel that way because they paid their bill in November, but they actually have received an exemption from July 1 of 18, and it'll continue on through June 30th of 19. So that's the year that they've currently received an exemption for. The amount of that exemption is in the PUC report. It's reported to be a little shy of $2.6 million. The company had reported in February of 2018 that they had invested about $2.6 million at that time. And then we heard last week that they had invested an additional, I think it was $1.1 million. So if you extended the exemption for an additional year, the PUC has estimated that would cost about $2.62 million. And so that would be a little bit more than what they've indicated that they've invested. They had said that they would like the exemption to continue through the end of this year, which would be 6 months. Typically, exemptions don't work that way, but the good folks at Legislative Council, I'm sure that they can come up with a way. Maybe it's a 50% exemption for 1 year, if that's what you feel, and that would actually give them, you know, a little bit more than what they've testified that they've spent. So the Department of Revenue, completely neutral on how you folks want to do that. We have just asked that, you know, we've noted that administratively there's some conflicting language. We anticipate that there's going to be for future litigation if we do get new applicants for this exemption. And so we would appreciate that anything that you could do to unwind that. You could clarify the existing law if you wanted to, but something to mitigate that from happening in the future would be really appreciated.
Any additional questions? It's been mentioned that perhaps other entities are waiting and watching and might want to apply for this exemption to take advantage of the situation that currently exists. To the best of your understanding, at what point would some other entity be making a decision that we're going to start now?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I'm uncertain exactly on when applications are due to the PUC. The PUC reported in their report that's available to you that they have not had anybody who's coming in currently. So I don't know exactly when someone might come in, but you know, the risk is that they. Because you can do a prospective application of a project that hasn't been built, so someone could come in. I mean, at any time, and apply to the PUC and ask that they get a project approved. So I think that risk is out there currently. And as I testified to last week, we've heard that at least one company that does kind of ground-based internet service provider is considering it. And then we also, this 5G, if you read anything online, it is amazingly fast. And it seems like it would be able to hit the symmetrical gigabit speed as well. And that would take basically all of our cell phone companies out of central assessment. So that would be that could be a significant issue for you.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Garst, can you repeat the dates that you said that the exemption was under current law, what it's going to be right now? You said, I think it was July 1st, 2018 through
June. through Chair Nathanson, Rep. Reschke, through June 30th of 2019.
Of this year, okay.
Is what the PUC is reporting has already been granted. And notice that I keep pointing to the PUC report. This information would not otherwise be available to you had you not required, as a part of Senate Bill 611, that there be a report on the exemption that gives you this information. Normally, this would be confidential, and I don't even know that I would be able to say that we had granted or not granted an exemption for a particular company. So this, if this is, information is helpful, something to think about going forward.
And just a follow-up.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think this is more a comment than a question for Mr. Garst, but my biggest heartburn, it probably isn't unique, is that this is a property tax exemption. And so you have a state entity taking away taxes from local entities. And something to consider in the discussion of how long this should go or whether it should close and all that, I think should be whether there's a mechanism to switch that or flip that to be an income tax credit or deduction as opposed to a property tax.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Garst. There is another person who would like to speak this morning. Come on up. To identify yourself.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Marsh, Vice Chair Finley, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jessica Epley from Frontier Communications. Just a couple of quick points that I wanted to add to the record. First of all, during the original testimony, there was discussion about this tax being granted in perpetuity, and it's germane to our conversation here today. Frontier's condition under which we get the exemption is that we build and maintain, and that maintain part is in many cases as expensive as the original build. It is extremely expensive to operate a system whereby you're segregating such a high level of bandwidth for a subset of your customer base. So I did want to make sure I made that point, as well as this property tax exemption has been redeployed as taxable base. So we've taken an intangible tax credit, put additional infrastructure in the ground, and broaden the tax base for school districts and cities and counties. That I don't know that point has been made as of yet, but we have actually made those investments in that way. It's not as though Frontier took the money and said, okay, thanks, Oregon, we appreciate it, and walked away. We've continued making those investments and continue to make those investments. With that, I would be happy to take any additional questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being back. But also in your testimony the other day, you said that if this ended, you thought you would probably take out of action or commission those investments. So wouldn't those investments go away?
Not out of, Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith Warner, not out of commission. Let me explain this a little differently. So in 2016, when we first built this project, the amount of bandwidth that was needed by our entire network in the state of Oregon was quite a bit less than what it is today. Because over the last 3 years, what has happened? More people are using Netflix and Amazon Prime. You're seeing line loss, as a traditional cable cut. I'll be honest, my family's running 55 devices on any given day because we have smart homes, we have the Amazon Echo Dot, we're doing some streaming, my kids have iPads, we have Kindles. I mean, there's a ton of devices. And so that pressure on that bandwidth continues to grow every single day, and that puts pressure on the availability. So it wouldn't be taking those resources out, it would be likely redeploying them to benefit more Oregonians.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And therefore, that investment, so you would still be utilizing those as part of your service. So indeed, you could maybe make an argument that it would be valid for those to continue to be taxed as part of your central assessment because you would still be utilizing those for other services that you're providing to your customers. Is that correct?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith-Warner, I don't want to misspeak. In essence, we've already done that. Because we've taken that tax credit, we've bought more infrastructure that increased our property tax base, that increased the tax overall. maybe I'm not, am I mistaking? I don't know.
Thinking about it.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Marsh.
Thank you. I know you went over the numbers on Friday, but it's been a long weekend. So can you just review for us exactly what the investments have been for you so far and the tax credits that you've received or the tax exemption value that you've received?
And Representative Marsh. So going back to our original investment in 2016, Frontier made, I apologize, I need to find my document, just a moment. And of course, my eyes aren't finding it as quickly as I would like to this morning. Frontier had made just over $2.6 million in our first year in investments. We made additional infrastructure investments in 2017 to 2018. And then 2018 to 2019, we had continued maintenance investments of $1.157. So I don't have 100% of the numbers, but I will be happy to get those for you. They're in a report that I don't have with me at the moment.
Okay, that would be great. Thank you.
Could you please clarify for us with a little bit more specificity, what is a maintenance investment? What are you spending the money on?
So when, thank you, Chair Nathanson, when a company is putting a product into service, you're going to buy what you need so that you can offer that line speed to the number of population that you need to. In this case, our first year out of the gate, I believe we were offering it 56% of our total base, which would be our Fios market, mostly in the Portland metropolitan area. And after you deploy that, you start getting customers rolling onto that, and you realize, okay, well, now we need to buy some additional cards. You need to buy some additional pieces of infrastructure. I am not an engineer, so I do not want to make these fine folks upset by misstating what they purchased. I have a laundry list of things that were acquired over that time period to continue offering at that speed level. Frontier did deploy some additional fiber as well to expand our availability of the symmetrical gig product within this space. And all of that is enumerated within the reports that go to Department of Revenue as well as the reports that go to the PUC.
Thank you. So what I'm understanding is that it's tangible things. It's
correct.
Objects, physical things. It's not just using software to divide up.
Provisioning.
Or reallocate.
Provisioning is what you're referring to. Absolutely. Yes, yes, that is exactly right. We bought things, and we have invoices for those things that were investments. And again, that's why I can say we did broaden the property tax base.
Representative Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I need to drill back and make sure I have this. Your 2016 investment was 2.6. What was your number for 2017?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Finley, I will need to get that information for you. I don't have that report in my folder. I thought I had it.
So, and I have your 18-19 number, but is it a valid number to say that so far your total exemptions you received is 2.6? Or are you still in litigation with that number?
And then Representative Finley, we have received 2.6 on paper. You'll note that it is February of 2019. That exemption will not conclude until June 30th of 2019. But that would be all of the exemption that Frontier has made, and that exemption would only exist during the years 2018 to 2019, when in fact we had made investments going back to 2016.
Okay, thank you.
Did you have any other questions? Thank you for being with us again today.
Thank you.
From the perspective of Legislative Revenue Office, do you have anything to add in the way of information or clarification?
I'm happy to put together some material. I would note that the bill last year was slightly different from this year's bill, and in the materials from last year, we did contemplate different phase-out scenarios and in that case, we also contemplated a retroactive repeal, whereas this one is just a clean repeal of the bill.
Okay. And Representative Marsh has a question.
Yes. I'm curious, if we were to choose to extend this to through the end of 2019, whether or not we could somehow exempt other entities for applying for it. Grandfather in exist people with existing exemptions with an extension without inviting the opportunity for new applications?
Representative Marsh, Chair Nathanson, I would assume that Legislative Council has a way of crafting a lot of different scenarios for this bill or what you guys would contemplate, but there's two stages that seem to be important to the gigabit bill, which is the Public Utility Commission's approval mm-hmm. of an application. And people have mentioned that approval, some of the confusing or problematic language is around whether it's a prospective project or if it's a completed project ready to go. Some of the conversations about the exemptions, whether Frontier or Comcast would be applying for that, is when their first year of service starts and offering that to those customers. So if you crafted something that specified the deadline of when they had to apply to the Public Utility Commission by maybe so today was the date, mm-hmm. then that would cut off all future applicants. And then following that, there seems to be a bit of conversation, I guess, around whether when the Public Utility Commission approves something, how that's treated by the Department of Revenue. And that was the subject of a lot of the back and forth last year.
Right.
So those are the stages at which it seems that you would be able to maybe draw a line in the sand. And one of them starts with the PUC application.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I am certain we are going to be coming back to this topic. I don't have anyone else signed up to testify. My intent is to close the public hearing and anticipate that we will be working on this and hearing from LRO about various options that might be available for amending this bill if the committee chooses to amend it. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bills 2168 and 2684. And now I'm opening an informational meeting, which will be followed by a public hearing on House Bill 2128. For right now, we're having an informational meeting on the tax expenditure report.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So this is just a continuation of the discussion in terms of regarding the tax expenditure policy. And I've just created a one-page document here that kind of tries to bring it back to some of the issues and potential law changes and some of the options before the committee as you're considering how to move forward on this topic. So just to restate the three, or as I've listed here, three issues, there may be more. Every time I think about this, I think about it in slightly different ways. But the first one is the identification of tax expenditures, exactly how that's done and by whom. So in the creation of a new tax or the tax policy that's crafted, it's on the minds of the Revenue Committee, but as tax policy is created in other committees, the transportation is the one that really comes to mind, and that's where a lot of these issues surface on the transportation package. And how the identification of the tax expenditures exist. It's that push and pull between the tax base and the tax expenditure. It's really that topic. The second issue is the impact of the implicit sunset law. In many ways, if we didn't have the implicit sunset law, then it becomes an academic discussion somewhat of what is or is not a tax expenditure. But with the automatic sunset provision, that's where there could be some conflict down the road about who decides what is a tax expenditure and whether or not it automatically sunsets. And that's tied to that law. So it's the interaction of the identifying a tax expenditure and the automatic sunset provision. And the third piece is the information that would be desired by the legislature. So as you're thinking about this, what kind of information and the timing of that information would be relevant for crafting future policy? So the second category I have is just potential law changes. And here I'm just starting a list of potential law changes. The first one would be the definition of a tax expenditure, and that's what you have in the bill before you that you'll be having a public hearing on in a minute. And that's House Bill 2128. And the way that's drafted, it certainly isn't meant to be it's meant to open a conversation. And what that does is changes the definition of a tax expenditure to remove provisions that are prohibited by federal law. If the feds say that you can't tax federal land, then there's nothing the legislature can do to tax that land. So in terms of the discussion of a tax expenditure, it has a different nature about the ability for you to craft policy with respect to taxation for that either income or property. The second one is to change the automatic sunset to an explicit sunset process. The fact that it's an implicit sunset opens the door for debate about what is or isn't a tax expenditure. That could be changed to an explicit sunset process, where perhaps statute simply identifies these are all the provisions that are specifically allowed to sunset at a given time. They're all kind of wrapped up into one list, so you can go to one spot in statute that identifies everything that's subject to a sunset review process. A third possibility or perspective is to establish a review process. And this would be separating a sunset process from a review process, where any provision doesn't automatically sunset. It just pops up in a review process for you to consider. So it doesn't have the effect of law of automatically ending the tax break, but it does automatically pop up on the radar screen for the legislature to say you need to review this. And then the legislature at the time can consider whether or not to sunset it, modify it, extend it. So it's a fundamental change in that process. And then one of the things that popped up in prior discussions were the requirement for a legislative intent document. And what I have here, the policy purpose statement, just to refresh your memory, I have basically a blank revenue impact statement here and for this bill. And we have these statements where this is the official revenue impact statement from LRL. This one obviously is not complete, but it has a measure description, then we'd have the revenue impact and then the explanation of the impact. And at the bottom, we have this checkbox about whether or not a provision creates, extends, or expands a tax expenditure, yes or no. And then we try to get in some language there around a policy purpose statement. Now, this doesn't really have the effect of law, but it puts it on the radar screen, at least from the perspective of LRO, whether or not something is a tax expenditure. And what it doesn't do is specifically say that something is not a tax expenditure. So this could be modified, or maybe this could be changed somehow. I just mentioned this on the list because it was brought up in prior discussions. And that's kind of a process change for the legislature. So that's just a running list of potential changes. And then the third item I had on here was a little more detail on a review process. And this is, again, stepping away from an automatic sunset to an automatic review. And so the high-level categories we have here are the property taxes are the main one. There are a couple bills out there that deal with sunsets. But if you step away from that and go to review process, you could go to, say, a 10-year cycle. And these are just, I'm just trying to throw out some ideas for discussion. And if you have a 10-year cycle, so that's five legislatures, it would be about 25 of them reviewed every session. And that's just for all the ones that don't currently have a sunset. So everything that's out there, it could go on some sort of review process. And this isn't taking away any that the legislature that you may decide doesn't really need to be part of that review process. For example, the tax exemption for federal land, maybe that doesn't need to be part of a review process because it's not within the legislature's purview to change that policy. And then the second category is the income tax. And I place the property tax first because we already have a piece of this policy on the income tax side. So here we have the tax credit review process, which is ongoing. And so that is a six-year cycle. So if you wanted to review all of the other income tax provisions, all of the non-tax credits, so we're talking about federal deductions, we're talking about exemptions, exclusions, those kinds of things, they could mirror the tax credit cycle of every 6 years, or they could mirror a hypothetical 10-year cycle on the property tax side. In there, you're talking about reviewing any 22 or 35 per biennium. And you can already see how the work starts to build up pretty quickly, where every biennium, you might have 40 or 50 of these to review. And experience from the current tax credit review process, where in any given year, the legislature has had between 9 and 15, that's still a fair amount of work for the assembly to take on. One consideration with the income tax is our connection to federal law. A lot of the tax expenditures that are in that thick book are because we tie to federal law. And so that always enters that discussion. That's something to keep in mind. And then the other taxes, we have about 14 or 15 other tax programs, and there are about 45 tax expenditures there. I didn't go through and list those, so that would, presumably you'd want that to fit in here somehow. So in thinking about what a review process might look like, some of the key considerations are who would conduct the review. That could be Legislative Revenue Office, it could be the Department of Revenue, those are entities that come to mind. It could be the interim revenue committees. And that can be work that goes throughout the interim so that when you get to the next legislative session, at least the revenue committee members are familiar with the ins and outs of the policy. So when it comes time to acting during the legislative session, there is already at least some of that groundwork done. And so in the January of the odd year, there's already a certain level of familiarity. And then to that end, what information is needed, what can be gathered. As we're learning from the tax credit review process, the big obstacles there are one, identifying a policy purpose, and then two, how do you evaluate that? We end up with data shortages, and often is the case. And we've encouraged the legislature, as tax credits are continued, to at least consider what kind of information might be useful to gather. But then that gets into fiscal considerations and who would gather that information and so forth. There is a lot of leeway on the data side or the information side, because these issues usually aren't black and white. Small pieces of information can often provide some insight, some direction. So it's not an all or nothing situation. Work performed by the interim committee, I already mentioned that one. It would be something if the committee wanted to take that on during the legislative day's meetings, somehow to chunk that out, depending on who's doing the work. And then the 4D there, the criteria for identifying these groups, is if the committee chooses to move forward with this process, it's, well, how do you divide the groups? So running with the property tax, and then say that's the desire, at least as a first step, is to establish a review process for the property tax provisions. And say you want to go with that 10-year cycle and you want to do 25 a biennium, how do you identify which group? They can be lined up by program purpose. You can take economic development ones or environmental ones, or split those up. And so each biennium, there is one program area that is analyzed, or they can be split up. And that level of discussion, if the committee chooses, would require a little more detailed list of exactly what these property tax exemptions are. And that's for those. That's how we handled the tax credit review process back in 2009. Don't think anybody here was here in 2009, at least on the Revenue Committee. And the starting point there was we had about 65 tax credits, and there were three broad groups, and this was put out by staff as something for the committee to consider. They were put into three groups with a six-year cycle, and more or less fit into these broad groups. I think one was economic development, one was a social policy, and one, I'm blanking on what the third one was, but they're very high-level groups. And once those were put out there, the committee made some modifications in terms of lining those up. And so that could be something for the committee to consider if you want to move forward with the review process.
Is it natural resources was the third one?
It could be natural resources, yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you looked at those groups and then you looked at the individual credits, they didn't always, they weren't obvious. Oh yeah, this is clearly, some clearly fit into that category, some not. But it was a matter of creating a process. And as we move forward, so we're about 10 years down the road there, a number of tax credits have been allowed to sunset, a few new ones have been created. And for timing issues, the, not that the groupings were ever pure, but they're less pure now than they were 10 years ago.
Yes.
And if I may say, another thing that has happened is people have figured out that if you move them up off cycle, it decreases, I think, the either the fiscal or the revenue impact. And that has been what I have noticed in the attempts to kind of move them to a different cycle, because you can do it and it looks much less expensive to do by changing the review date.
That was something that, to that point, that was something the committee grappled with for the first few years, because some tax credits did involve investment decisions by the private sector. So the argument was that they needed lead time. Oftentimes, tax credits are reviewed by the legislature in the year in which they sunset. So take the current batch right now, the earned income tax credit is being reviewed, and under current law, it sunsets at the end of this year. So there is a revenue impact, this biennium, to extending it if a tax credit is reviewed biennium early, so to speak, then that first year biennium impact tends to be zero, and it's just in later years. Our revenue impact statements, I didn't include a table here, but we have a table here that's a three biennium table.
Yeah.
So you can see that.
See it. Yeah.
You do see that.
Yeah. It's handy that it never happens in the year you're talking about.
This is an extremely useful document, discussion document. I would like to be sure that we open the public hearing and hear from anyone who came to the meeting today to speak to the bill, House Bill 2128. And then after we've heard public testimony, we can have committee discussion on the bill and also all of this report. Is that all right? Mm-hmm. I'm not closing the informational meeting, but I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2128.
Nobody signed up.
And no one has signed up to testify. Shall I close the public hearing? Might as well, to keep it clean. Okay. And is that accurate? There's no one to testify. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2128. Committee, let's have some discussion on this document. And I'll start by saying I am interested in the idea of a review process. Automatic sunsets seem to capture a kind of attention that isn't necessarily the intent. But I would be interested in establishing, to the extent we can, a more routine review process so that it's just part of our normal operating business. But there were other parts of this paper that you've prepared for us that are also very useful. So the floor is open for discussion. Yes, Representative Brushke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the sunset, because it forces you to review, right? That's kind of the intent behind a sunset, auto sunset, is that you have to review it in order to decide whether you're going to leave it, renew it or not. I like the review process better because I think it's, and I like the 10-year better because of the workload, and I like the interim part of it as well. That gives this committee some real focus on, we know what's going to happen from July until next February, because we'll have, our plate will be full. And we can certainly discuss other things, but I think it just gives some predictability for not only the committee, but for those that take advantage of these different credits and expenditures.
Thank you, Chair. I just had a few perhaps unrelated comments. First of all, I think Chris sort of made the case for a full-time legislature when he laid all that out. 100 property tax exemptions, 150 roughly income tax issues to look at. And the other general comment is I'm struck by how the contrast between the response you got when you asked for a public hearing and the response we would get if we named one single property tax exemption and said we were going to look at it. So we're still in a safe place to have this conversation before we name things. I am wondering if we had a work group that just took on, for example, the property tax exemptions, I wonder as we worked through those the first time, whether we would see that they fall into distinct kind of categories in a first cut. You know, maybe they don't all have to be reviewed all the time. Maybe some of them are simply not going to change. But it seems like a great project for a little focused work group to take a first cut at looking through what in either the property tax exemptions or the income tax deductions, subtractions, whatever, consist of. I mean, we have the big book, but we haven't looked at it in terms of what our role should be as a legislature, and then report back to us. That's what I would suggest.
Thank you. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's a great idea, Representative Marsh. I'm sure Chris does too. more work for LRO. So I actually am of two minds on the review versus sunset, because on the one hand, I do like the kind of establishing regularity of review. On the other hand, sunset. So I just did a little session the other day for a group of activists. I did a How a Bill Becomes a Law. And I started with what I always start with, which is there's only one way to pass a bill, but there's about a zillion ways to kill a bill. And I mentioned that because that's how I feel about the whole sunset versus review. Is my concern about review would be it would be easier for us to just kind of let things roll on, even if maybe they don't seem that great, but people could gin up enough, you know, concern about it that it would just keep going. Whereas with the sunsets, we have to take an affirmative action. And I think there's a lot to be said for that, to kind of force us to have a real public conversation about the policy goals of what those credits are. And I like the idea of forcing a more public discussion of those tax expenditure ideas as well. So,
yes, Representative Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I tend to agree. Whenever you talk about any of these, I don't know how many letters you folks have gotten, but I've received a tremendous number of letters over House Bill 2152, because it discusses we're going to review some of these tax credits. And so there's a lot of angst. There's no discussion about elimination of any of them. There's just a discussion of a review of them. But I believe that every one of them should be reviewed, as in it's a fiduciary responsibility to look at. Just because they were put in at the time, it made a lot of sense, but do they still make sense? And are they meeting the objectives of what they started? So I think, and I believe it's work that this body should be doing with great staff work from the LRO and the Department of Revenue. I mean, I think that's what we're elected to do. So I think we ought to, I believe in the review process. And I believe in the sunset process, and we need to actively look at them and actively touch those and say, yeah, this is doing what it needs to do or it needs to be tweaked.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Finley. And I think that whole reviewing how they got to where they are, because regardless of how many or few years you've been here, you will often hear stories about, oh, well, that was part of this whole other deal that was about these three things, and then that got thrown in as part of the compromise about this something else. And so truly, once that context is gone or over, that really begs the need to look at it and say, okay, but on its own, does it make sense? Is it providing a policy achievement, you know, something that we actually want or need or not? So I just want to reinforce, I agree with that fiduciary responsibility idea.
Absolutely. A great discussion from this morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
when I look at the document, some of those issues are separable from the topic of the review process. Thinking about tax expenditure and tax base was it was a fascinating conversation. It's also something that really should be solved. We need to help Department of Revenue by providing some legislative intent or more certainty around that aspect. I'm not sure how to work through a discussion of that. And are we talking about administrative rules or a bill? Do we need to do something statutory? Mr. Allenack, what do we need to do to address this, to help resolve the problems that we've learned emanate from this lack of clarity?
Part in the discussions I've had with the Department of Revenue in with respect to identifying a tax expenditure, the challenge that they have, as I understand it, is they look at the bills and the laws. So they're just reading that language. And from that pure language, they try to discern if something is or is not a tax expenditure. And that's where you get the challenge of how an idea or how that base is expressed in statute. One of the slides from last week was was trying to connect the concept of a tax expenditure to specific provisions in law. And sometimes it maps, it's one-to-one, and sometimes it's not. And as we've had discussions with DOR, they reach out as part of their normal process, and they ask input from us as well as other stakeholders. And we are able to provide some additional context and legislative intent on how language got to be the way it is. So somewhere in there, I think there's a solution to providing clarity to what is it, what's part of a tax base and what's part of a tax expenditure. And the Department of Revenue, they struggle with some of these. Many of them most of them probably are pretty straightforward. It's the 80-20 rule again, where it's a small number that creates a situation where DOR, okay, do they leave it in or leave it out? And what's relevant now, what has changed, is if a tax expenditure has sunset, they need to enforce their focus is to enforce the tax laws. So if a tax credit is deemed to have been sunsetted, they can't allow it. And so it's that ambiguity that I'm trying to address. So in some ways, it's a process side for the legislature. And that's why I mentioned something along on the long lines here, where we talk about, at least in this checkbox, now this doesn't have the force of law, it's just our revenue impact statement, the extent to which something creates or extends or expands, but there's nothing on the opposite side saying there is no tax expenditure here. So that there might be a path forward in there. It would probably, for the Department of Revenue's perspective, it would probably be better if it were in statute as opposed to on a legislative document. But we can hear from them at some point if the committee chooses on what how they feel about that. But I think somewhere in there is that ambiguity. And again, it's really the connection of a review or sunset process and this automatic sunset that creates that practical situation.
I feel like it's important to resolve this. It's not urgent. The situation has been in place for a while. I would like us to, as a committee, to make progress on resolving this, whether it's scheduled in a week or a few months from now when the crush of new bills coming to us, things with deadlines, when that crush has passed, maybe that's when we finish a discussion of this, but I'd like this to stay on our radar and it pick this up where we leave off, whether it's in a few days or a few weeks from now. Each one of these things that needs to be resolved. Anyone else have some thoughts? Could you scroll back up to...
Can I ask one last clarifying question? Yes. Could you go to your document? Oh, there we go. For some reason, this is either this fell out of my head. Under number two, change automatic sunset to an explicit sunset process. I think I was, I stopped paying attention for a second when you were going through that, and I cannot quite remember what that means. I know.
Well, I think the point isn't fully developed in my mind, for one, but so that's probably part of the problem. We have this automatic sense that there's the provisional law that says any tax expenditure created after 1/1/14 automatically sunsets after 6 years, unless stated otherwise, because the legislature can always modify it. So you take that concept, so in and of itself, that seems pretty clear. If you create a new, and people usually think in terms of a tax credit. Well, if you created a tax credit and the legislature doesn't specify a sunset date, then it's automatically 6 years. You take that concept and you marry it with whether or not something is a tax expenditure is where we run into a problem. Is because, and a tax expenditure is a much broader definition, so you have deductions and exemptions. And the most confusing piece, or ambiguous, might be a better word, is on exclusions. So as the legislature is creating a new tax, you know, the bike tax or the privilege tax, and is working to define the tax base, depending on how that tax base is laid out in statute, if somebody else comes along, not part of those conversations, and reads the statute, there's an argument to be made that while the legislature was defining a tax base, somebody else might interpret the creation of tax expenditures.
The wheelchair argument.
Yeah. And if that other entity is the, and what we're talking about, that other entity being the Department of Revenue, who enforces the tax laws, and they will do the work that they need to do, and they will do their due diligence, and talk to the AG, everything that goes into the work that they do, if their best read on the tax law is that something is a tax expenditure and does in fact sunset, then they will enforce the tax laws to that effect. And if a taxpayer disagrees with that, now we've created a situation where the Department of Revenue and a taxpayer are disagreeing, and then it can potentially go down into, you know, worst case scenario, a court case. And that's what you'd arguably like to avoid, just providing that clarity. And so that's where it's the automatic piece of that. And if somehow that can be converted to an explicit process.
Which would be the best.
That eliminates the intent. Ideally. Yeah, the goal being to eliminate that ambiguity.
Thank you.
So we will, of course, be continuing to consider House Bill 2128, since it's part of this topic that includes that as well as some other business that we need to take care of. One last thing, since we have 5 minutes left, I'd like to hear if anyone on the committee has any thoughts on this potential choice when we're going to have a review of something. Is it LRO or DOR or some other entity? Or is it all of them? Is it an either or all participate a little bit? And that still doesn't get at, but what about the agency that oversees the activity that it was intended to provide an incentive or disincentive for? With, you know, housing, food security, investment in farming equipment, you know, the different sorts of things that it's meant to address. Where does the review from that agency that usually deals with that topic come into play? Or is it up to LRO or DOR to contact that agency and then work with that information, synthesize it, analyze it, and present it to us, rather than the agency direct to us? So,
Madam Chair, haven't we done some work on that in engaging the agencies in tax credits, like around the, sorry to say it out loud, Betsy, and some other issues like that? Didn't that cause us to create some sort of a either process or at least talk about it?
Yes. So a little historical context. The tax expenditure report created in 1995, the current one, includes in it an evaluation by the state agency.
Oh, that's what it is.
So that's one piece. So there are such evaluations included in there, and I'll leave it at that. And then by 2013, so then we get to the tax credit review process being created in 2009. And then we get to 2013 and the legislature decides that you want more information on the tax credits. So since 2013, the LRO are statutorily required to produce a tax credit report report. And within that, we do try to compare these indirect spending programs with direct spending programs. We reach out to LFO and try to identify direct spending programs that are similar in program goal to these indirect. And we can talk about the indirect versus the direct, and we do reach out to the state agencies. So prior reports, we reached out to the Department of Energy. I know I reached out to housing when we had the lenders credit up. And so there is that work, so it could be building along those lines. It's really to get more stakeholders involved so that the legislature mm-hmm. has the best information possible.
So we could choose to just carry that process forward to other types of tax expenditures beyond just tax credits. Yes, Representative Marsh.
I would just add, I'm particularly interested in the property tax exemptions. I think we tend to sometimes throw those around because we feel like they aren't going to cost us that much money, but they do cost somebody money. And we don't necessarily hear from local governments as to the effectiveness of those because they may or may not embrace them. They may or not may not evaluate them. And so I think a good dive into what we've set up those 100 property tax exemptions and the need to review them, which we haven't done at all, would be a great exercise for us.
Any other comments on this topic before we conclude for the day? Thank you all for a good discussion on not on that bill directly, but on tax expenditures in general. Thank you all. We're adjourned.